46. Jin. Jin went from imagining Flick guiding him out of the fire to feeling her hands on his arms, helping him to his feet. "You saved me," he almost said, but that would be the delirium speaking. She wasn't real. The smoke had conjured her. The cobblestones outside Spindrift were littered with debris from the blast. An audience of Atenians in vibrant skirts and wool coats had gathered as if this were the latest play at the theatre. Horror was muffled by excitement, by fingers jabbing at the smoke, curling thicker than the smokestack plumes, the fire brighter than the Atenian sun. Not one of them had come to his aid. He wanted to yell at them all. "Jin." He blinked down at Flick. She was real. She pulled him away from the fire and into safety, dragging him from the bones of his home. He was still holding Arthie in his arms. Barely. Flick hailed them a carriage. She helped him carry Arthie inside, gave Jin water to wet his parched throat, sat beside him as the driver spurred the horses in the direction of Ivylock Street. Arthie needed care, and as outlandish as it sounded, the Aetherium was the safest place for them right now. "Jin," Flick said again, concern heavy in her voice. "Say something." "You came back for us," he rasped at last. He could barely move his arms. His legs felt just as weak. The rumbling of the carriage made him want to hurl his insides. He wanted to retch, scream, sob. "Of course I did," Flick said softly. The carriage trundled onward, the sounds of the city slipping through the seams. Newsboys shouting, horses whinnying, people going about as if this was any ordinary day. And it was, for them. Buildings rushed past the carriage window, each of them intact and untouched, bricks as perfect as Spindrift's had been this morning. Flick took her handkerchief and wet it, using it to wipe the soot from his skin. His eyes burned. He wanted to pull away from her touch. It was too caring, too tender. It ripped away the last of his resolve, and Jin couldn't hold them in any more. The tears fell, and he did nothing to stop them. He could do nothing to stop them. He had bottled them up since the proprietor had given them the news. "Oh, Jin," Flick whispered. She pulled him against her and adjusted herself so that his face rested in the crook of her shoulder, enveloping him in wildflowers and sunlight. Everything the remains of Spindrift was not. His tears fell onto her skin and dampened her dress, but she held him firmly. "It's gone," he managed to say. "I know," Flick said, eyebrows pitched earnestly. "And I'm sorry. I know how much it meant to you. It was a horrible, horrible thing to do. A dirty move on the ram's part. But your crew is alive. You and Arthie survived. And in this war against the ram, you're already winning." He angled his head to look at Arthie stretched out across the double seats across from them, frail and unconscious. Flick was right. She swiped at her own face and then breathed a little laugh because he noticed. "When I didn't see either of you at first. I was worried I had left my old life behind, only to lose my new one too." Her new life. Was that what she thought of them? Of him? "Killing us is no easy task," Jin said. "We're annoying like that." Flick laughed again, louder this time, drowning out a sob. He sat back and dragged a thumb up her cheek, wiping away the stray tear, freezing her in place. Jin remembered the last time they'd been in a carriage together, when she'd tumbled into his lap. That felt like forever ago. She must have been thinking the same, for she tilted her head at him. "And this job had its victories. We have the ledger, the truth. You learn something about your parents." He had so much to tell them. which made him realise something else. He had spent so many years fixated on the past, worried and afraid of what might befall him again, that life had up and happened without him. Arthi twitched, but didn't awaken. It was as she'd said, time and time again. He was always so worried about taking risks and potentially losing Spindrift that he rarely took time to fully enjoy and appreciate it. "Don't overthink," Flick whispered. Chin clenched his jaw. She leaned closer and brushed ash from his hair. His breath caught. Flick froze too, realizing how little space there was between them. Classic Flick. If he tilted his head forward a fraction, he could brush his nose against hers. If he tilted his head to the right or left, he could kiss her soft, unblemished cheek. If he dipped even closer, he could kiss her lips. "Chin, I..." She stopped, eyes dropping to his mouth. Her hands had been all over him moments ago. Funny how it was her gaze that made him shiver now. He leaned closer, running his tongue over his lips, pleased he didn't taste like soot. Her fingers curled into his thighs, as if she was bracing herself. If only she knew what that was doing to him. Wicked knives, it was doing things to him. And neither of them noticed that the carriage had stopped until the door was flung open. Flick made a little squeak. Chin wrenched away, adjusting his trousers as discreetly as he could. The dubious face of the driver peered between them, the Ethereum behind him. We're here. 47. Arthi. When Arthi opened her eyes, she couldn't remember the last time she'd closed them. She sat up and everything rushed back. Spindrift. Her home. Her joy. Her life. Gone. There was an armchair by her bed and an unlit hearth beside it. She knew this place. She recognised the illustrated ceiling and those ornate walls. The Ethereum. She slumped back into the pillows and ran her hands down her ribs, making sure everything was in place. She'd felt every crash and shatter of Spindrift as if it were her own body. As if she had been tethered to it by a thread. And the ram had come and snipped it clean, leaving her bereft. The emptiness was as loud as the hunger gnawing at her insides. She almost laughed. She almost gave in to the mayhem thrashing beneath the surface. She was tired of powering forward. She was tired of outsmarting the next hurdle. Her pistol was on the bedside table. She holstered it, tucking a piece of herself back in place, and forced herself out of the bed. She needed to check on Jin and her crew. She was an animal pacing in a cage. Something was rippling through her, begging to be unleashed. "Please, please, please." A sob tore out of her, draining the last of her will, forcing her down to her knees on the rug in the room's centre. In this game between her and the ram, she had lost. Lost her home, lost her life, and worst of all, lost the control she had so carefully cultivated. A whisper of a sound pulled her out of her thoughts. Something white drew her attention. A white orchid that symbolised missing someone. Bat hadn't been there before. A figure drew near, silhouetted against the curtains. She recognised the shape of him. His scent that heightened her senses. Laith. That couldn't be right. He couldn't be alive. He couldn't be roaming free in the Ethereum of all places. Arthi. He spoke her name on a twisted exhale, stepping into the lamplight. She shivered in anticipation and gritted her teeth against it. It was him. You're alive. She should have apologised, but the words refused to form on her tongue. She could barely form coherent thoughts. A shaky laugh broke out of her instead. "You're here to kill me, aren't you? after what I did to you." His gaze swept down her body, and he took a step closer. "If only that were true. I loathed you, Arthi. I hated you for the span of a heartache before I realized how much I craved you. And I know you yearn for me the same." Arthi did, she realized. She looked for him at every turn, when learning the truth about the Ram's ledger, when the flames tore through Spindrift. "And I understand why you did it," he said. "I wasn't as forthcoming as I should have been. I apologize." He spoke the words too quickly. He forgave her too quickly. If only Arthi could think clearly. There was a piece she was missing, and she only needed to rearrange the puzzle that was him for it all to click into place. "I heard about Spindrift. It's gone," she said, and her voice broke. "I know," he replied softly, too calm for her chaos. "I know. I'm sorry." "The others?" "Safe," he said. "Your crew is at Imperial Square. Jin, Flick, and Mateor are here. I learned about the ledger too. It is safe to say I don't work for the Ram any longer." She glanced at his breast pocket. Sure enough, his robes didn't bear the badge of the Horned Guard. "Why don't you let go?" she asked suddenly. The words burst out of her. "Why live for the dead when you have a life of your own?" Laith paused, taken aback. "The past cannot be forgotten." No, it could not. Only death would take her past from her. "But can it be forgiven?" "My heart seeks a peace I may never know," Laith said. "Until I find it, I do not know how to live any other way." "Lex Talionis," she murmured. She knew what peace he spoke of, even if she'd never considered it as more than a wound in her chest, a hole she could never fill. How long can vengeance last? An eternity. Until they suffered the same fate. Until justice is struck. Her thoughts bled into one another. She needed to stuff all her broken edges back into a tailored suit and return to what she was. Nothing made sense but her hunger. His clothes rustled in the silence. And then she felt the ghost of his fingers at her jaw, lifting her chin. He lifted his hand slowly, waiting for her to pull away. When the light from between the curtains dipped his fingers in gold, it held her in place. When it danced across the smooth curve of his cheek, she stared. He traced a swoop of her hair, curling it behind her ear, his gaze following the movement like a beast tracking its prey. He pressed closer, and impossibly, her head tilted without her consent. "If there is anyone who can endure an eternity, it is you." When she felt the feather of his breath along her skin, she felt dangerously like giving in. His finger swiped her lip, and that hunger amplified. It wanted to ravage and destroy. It wanted, and she couldn't stop it. "I know what you are, Arthi," he whispered. His voice held the barest of tremors. "I've known since the day I met you." She pulled away from him, freezing as she searched the planes of his face. How? How could he know? "Tell me, do you remember what it's like to live?" He grazed his fingers down the side of her arm, depriving her of her ability to think. "Let me help you." She inhaled, devouring the scent of his blood, the fervor in his veins. It assaulted her, drove her mad. She wanted to unleash her rage upon him. She wanted to crack open his ribcage and crawl inside of him. He loosened the sash of his robes and let them fall to the rug with a soft hush. He undid the trio of buttons on the top of his linen shirt and bared the unmarred skin of his throat. His eyes were as dark as her heart, a sea at dusk. Let me bleed for you. When that healer in Ceylon had told Arthi's mother that only a miracle could save her daughter, he had taken Arthi in his arms, as if she weighed no more than a sack of rice, and set her down in the back of his hut, with its coconut palm leaf thatched roof and snaking wisps of incense smoke. He moved with impossible speed. One moment he was there, considering her. The next, he was striking himself like a viper. When she gasped, he pressed his wrist to her mouth. She didn't know what made her drink. A fire started in her limbs, sweeping through her veins in invisible torrents, consuming her, draining her, filling her with hunger even though she had just eaten. "What's happening to me?" she had asked, voice rising. "You must live for those who will not," he said. And then the darkness swallowed her up, only for an instant, an eternity, a minute or many, and when she opened her eyes, the healer was gone. Or maybe she had left his hut. She moved too quickly. Every sound rang too loudly. Around her, people were screaming and running. Atenian soldiers were coming, they said. Angry waves swallowed bobbing boats. A storm was coming too. "Arthi!" She ran in the direction of her mother's voice, feeling stronger than she could ever remember. She looked down at her black-stained hands and sticky fingers. She angled them toward the sunlight, creeping through the smoky skies, and realized they weren't black, but the darkest shade of red. Blood. Hands gripped her, pulled her close. The embrace was warm, a feast to satisfy her hunger. "No," she reprimanded herself. This was her mother, shouting at her to hurry, and her father steering her in the direction of their boat. Arthi ran for the crashing waves, unafraid because she loved the sea. But when the water lapped at her limbs now, she hissed at the way it burned her skin, like a thousand needles piercing into her. Still, Arthi powered forward. She reached the boat. There were two girls in it already, their eyes wide as saucers. She turned back, her hand outstretched, but neither of her parents was behind her. They were back at the shore, and as Arthi watched, they died at the hands of the Atenians. Death bleeds red, no matter the colour of one's skin. They called her father Kalu Asoka, because there was another Asoka in their village who was lighter skinned. They called her mother Netta Dasaka, because she was the tallest one of the three in the village. But when they lay on the sand, eyes glassy, riddled with holes large enough to see the glint of the bullets, it was all the same. A pool of red, a pool of injustice, a pool of death. To this day, Arthi remembered her hunger at the sight of them. She did not mourn. She did not weep. That craving engulfed her. The villagers mistook her wild abandon for grief. They pinned her to the boat. Perhaps it was one of the girls, or the man who joined to turn the oars. Arthi lashed out against them, angry tears rivaling the torrents pouring from the dark skies as they pushed out to sea. They couldn't understand. And then she stopped. The boat rocked on the waves in silence, the three companions looking grim and guilty at their own relief. They didn't know she'd come to realize something. She didn't need her parents to feed her. No one could care for her now but herself. Later, much later, once the skies had cleared and she'd put enough distance between her and Ceylon's shores, an Atenian ship found her. One lone girl in a boat full of blood. She was too small and too brown and too dirty, but she somehow found herself on the threshold of Penn's mansion weeks after the Atenians had found her bloody boat. Where they'd nudge one another while spooning slop into their mouths and share quips she couldn't understand, but knew for certain were jibes at her. At that point, she was oscillating between pain and anger, wishing her hunger hadn't disappeared so that she could unleash the monster inside of her, wishing she could stop reliving her final moments in Ceylon. She remembered bits and pieces after that, setting foot on the Atenian pier, the damp cold she'd never known before, the carts and the horses and all those voices and buildings. She remembered the way her footsteps echoed in Penn's foyer when she entered with her water-warped shoes. It sat behind a trim lawn, carved with a winding path where a carriage had been parked, a pair of horses waiting patiently. The housekeeper was telling her something. Arthi didn't understand what until she demonstrated, getting to her knees and scrubbing at the floors. She didn't see a single speck of dirt on the glossy floorboards, but she nodded. She didn't know what else to do. At home, in Ceylon, her mother would only make her clean once she'd returned from school and had gotten some time to play in the sea with the other children. No one asked about her studies here. No one seemed to see her as a child, only another pair of hands meant for work. The doors swung open for a pair of guards with rifles against their shoulders. Arthi shrank back with a strangled cry and squeezed her eyes shut. The house fell silent. Arthi remained very still as a shadow engulfed her. "Open your eyes, little lion." It was a language she understood. A man was crouched in front of her. He was about her father's age, but carried himself in a statelier fashion. Aristocratic, she would later learn. His hair was tied at the nape of his neck, and a brilliant red ruby sat in the ruffled knot of fabric under his throat. He looked Atenian white, but he spoke her language. "That was why they brought her to him," he said. When he smiled, she saw something sharp, and she touched her tongue to those sharp thorns of her own. He laughed. "Fangs." He lowered his voice, and it felt as if they were sharing a secret. "Draw them in, and no one will know." He regarded her oddly and held a finger under her nose, where her breath came out in fearful, tiny sniffs. "Fascinating," he said, more to himself than to her. "You're alive, but also a vampire. I've been trying to find someone like him." She still didn't know of whom he spoke, and it would take her a long, long time to realize she'd been abandoned in an in-between state. Half here and now and alive, the other half lost at sea. Half human, half vampire. Her growth trickled to an end when she neared 16. Her heartbeat petered to a halt. She cast a shadow, but not a reflection. For she wasn't near death when she was fed a vampire's blood. That was why she'd wreaked havoc on that little boat, eerily similar to what the Wolf of White Roaring had done years before her. Perhaps if she'd stayed with Penn, she would have learned all that and more. He told the housekeeper that she wouldn't be part of the staff. Instead, he gave her a room and a maid and care. But a man like Penn Arundel couldn't always be home, and a growing girl could not always remain sated. Not long after she moved in with him in Imperial Square, that hunger returned, consuming Arthi's consciousness until there was nothing else. Penn found her that night in the bathroom, staring at her maid in a tub full of blood. It was his reaction that scared her. His face scrunched in pain, and Arthi braced for a reprimanding, but he drew her against him, enveloping her in a wall of comfort and safety. "It would be all right," he said. He would help her. She only needed to trust him. Months later, her hunger struck again, and he wasn't there to stop it. Arthi stumbled into the kitchens, gripping the doorframe, claws digging into the wood. Everyone but the cook's young daughter ran. She cornered her. It didn't matter who the girl was, only that she was breathing, that blood pumped through her veins, frenzying at Arthi's approach. Please, she begged. Please, please, please. Arthi spent hours shivering near the kitchen door. The cook screamed. Pen didn't come. His household began whispering and whispering until she couldn't take it anymore. She ran. Arthi spent days huddling in the alleys of white roaring streets. She saw other vampires bewitching humans into baring their throats, just for a taste. She didn't trust herself to hold that same restraint, and so she starved. She vowed never to drink another drop of blood again. She clung to the humanity she remembered, the remains of what had been stolen from her. Some nights, she screamed into the darkness until her body felt numb. She found other ways to stay busy, other emotions to feel. The colour bled from the world, and life became a curse. Until she met a boy with a coconut. 48. Arthi. Arthi shook her head when Laith sank to his knees in front of her. She had ached from restraint, from holding herself back, ever since that last glass of coconut water. I'm dangerous, she said, but she felt herself giving in. She had nothing left to lose. As am I, he murmured, and her fangs elongated for the first time in years at the smooth cut of his voice. This wasn't nearly the same. Once she started, she might not stop. She might not stop until she'd ripped him apart. Laith closed the distance between them, and Arthi was moving before she could stop herself. Something carnal replacing reason, something starved coming to light. She dropped her head to his shoulder with anguish. His warmth made her quiver. His breathing quickened, striking the crook of her own shoulder. You need to leave, she whispered. Before. No, he whispered back. Destroy me. He pulled his head to the side, baring his throat. Why? She wanted to ask. What did he want from her in return? Arthi's nostrils flared at the scent of his blood, dark and enchanting. She tilted her face, the heat of him pulsing against her skin, beckoning, calling. He pulled away, drawing his shirt over his head in one quick move and discarding it to the side. She unclenched her fists and lifted her hands to his exposed chest. Laith's breathing broke, stopped, started afresh. She thought he said her name. She thought she'd forgotten what it was like to feel warm. His skin scorched her hands, muscles coiling as he watched her exploration. She wanted to speak, to tell him she'd never touched a boy like this before. His whispered laugh wound through her. When I first set eyes on you with your mauve hair and the knife-sharp smiles, I swore you would be a means to an end. When we met for the first time in your office, I realized it would be harder to keep that oath. And then? She asked. He lifted a hand to the back of his neck, something like torture in his eyes. She wished she knew the reason for it. She wished she knew what was holding him back. She wished she could think straight. And then you would use your mouth to cut me down in the most wicked of ways, and I realized I'd met countless men and women, but never my mirror. Was that what she was? They were different in every way, but also very much the same. She took a step forward. And now? He trailed the backs of his fingers down her cheek. And now I found a kindred spirit whose heart beats for the same pain. I don't know what I want anymore. Kindred spirit. She slid her nose up the plane of his skin, curling her fingers into his hair. His pulse was a rabid thrum against her. She parted her lips and pressed her mouth to the curve of his neck. Arthi. He sounded as starved as she was. She wondered what it would be like to kiss him, to claim him, to devour the mystery of this boy from some faraway land. Her mind showed her the maid in the tub, the girl in the kitchens, the refugees in the boat. I'm feral, wild, beastly, hungry, he whispered to her. She sank her fangs into his neck, twin blades breaking the skin. The heat of his blood flooded her tongue, metallic and sweet, a melody in her mouth, coursing down her throat and filling that eternal cold. She was different now. She was in command of herself. Not a starved, confused little girl. Laith bucked against her with a rasp, one hand disappearing into her hair, the other slipping down the curves of her body until he gripped her thigh. She gasped at the heat of him, pushing closer to please that dull ache. Don't, he begged. Don't stop. She didn't stop. They staggered to their feet, locked in a drunken dance. The rumble of his groans shot through her as she retracted her fangs and welcomed this new rush. This ache she'd never experienced before. She kissed the curve of his neck and laved her tongue down the bloody nicks. She hadn't realized how deeply her strength had depleted until it returned. Fire pumped through her veins, filling her to near bursting, giving way to a different need pulsing through her, a different kind of hunger. Laith's hand slipped down her body, gripped her ribs, her waist, higher, lower, everywhere. There. Her pistol. Arthi wasn't hungry anymore. Her mind was not clouded by starvation. And suddenly, everything wrenched to a startling halt as the pieces fell into place. The way Calibor's intricate filigree reminded her of Laith. Those accidental brushes of her pistol. His keen interest in how it worked. The story of the Hylia his sister was sent to retrieve. It was Calibor. Her pistol was the Hylia. He had never intended on taking down the ram. He hadn't cared about the ram or the ledger. He had simply played his part, feeding her lies and sidling closer and closer to the pistol. Touching her, goading her, coaxing her to drink from him when she'd sworn never to do so ever again. She stared at the twin punctures at his neck, her broken oath. This would end now. His chest heaved, still bare and begging for her touch, his lips swollen and inviting. He must have noticed the change in her, because he hesitated. Arthi, what? Arthi threw him against the wall, knocking the breath out of him. She had forgotten how much stronger a vampire could be when freshly fed. She had forgotten how sharp her claws could become. She pressed the five of them against the delicate flesh of his throat. I should kill you, she whispered. Rip you to shreds. Tear you apart for even thinking you could take Calibor from me. Understanding dawned in his dazed eyes. He had known it was inevitable. Would you not have done the same? He asked, his voice strained. And that was precisely why she couldn't kill him. She had used him as much as he'd used her. Neither of them had expected the raw desire that would bloom between them, angry vines drawing them close. Neither of them had expected to find their match in the other. Mirror indeed. Leave, she said softly, while your blood is only on my teeth and not splattered on these walls. If I see you again, I won't be so kind. 49. Arthi. Arthi watched Laith leave. She was never one to mourn, but here she was, mourning Spindrift, mourning the oath she'd made to herself. Some part of her mourned him, too. He had used her, disrespected her, nearly robbed her. And yet, he was a knot of emotion she didn't yet know how to unravel. She was grateful to be rid of him, and sad to have chased him away. She was not looking forward to telling Jin that he had been right. Their high captain of the Horn Guard truly couldn't be trusted, and it wasn't for the reason either of them had expected. Arthi stepped out of the room and turned down the hall, coming face to face with Matea. He looked different now that her hunger had abated. Blood rushing through her veins, bubbly and fresh. Everything looked more alive, vibrant, less tunneled in darkness. He saw her and froze. "No, Arthi," he whispered. "Tell me you didn't." He rarely called her by her name. "You did," Matteo said, stepping closer. His hand twitched as if he wanted to reach for her. "You fed on him." "You knew about me," Arthi said. Pen truly had told him everything. There was pain in Matteo's eyes. Something almost like defeat. Betrayal. What she did surely couldn't affect him that much. "I've known for years," he said, but he didn't know what she'd done. He didn't know what she was capable of. "Even if I didn't, it wouldn't be hard to assume as much about the owner of Spindrift." "What I am has nothing to do with Spindrift," she said. The sconces flickered in the hall, drenching him in shadow. "No? Is it coincidence, then, that the moment you lose Spindrift, you lose the restraint you had cultivated for years?" Arthi couldn't summon more than a whisper. "How do you know that?" "Call us kindred spirits," Matteo said softly. His shoulders loosened with his sigh. "I like to observe, Arthi. I knew you were a half-vampire, but I noticed any time the conversation of blood came up, you didn't act as most vampires do. You looked disgusted. Any time I offered a drink, you look repulsed." "Kindred spirit." From Laith, the words had sounded empty. From Matteo, something struck her differently, setting her at ease, like a part of her was settling into place. Was it true? Had she tied her restraint to Spindrift? Or had the timing of her coconut water's depletion simply coincided with the tragedy? No, she'd downed the last of it before they left for the Aetherium, and she had handled that entire job well enough. Matteo was right. "Why do you care?" she asked, hating that her voice sounded like a plea. Hating that someone could care for a wound she was allowing to fester. "You're a vampire. Would you not want me to embrace it?" "Embracing and giving in are not the same thing," he said. The words struck like a blow. Arthi's chest heaved. She slumped back against the wall, her eyes fluttering closed. "I can't." It broke out of her in a strangled whisper, hollow and dejected. It was defeat in a teacup, as tiny as a sugar cube, as weighty as a mountain. "Stop punishing yourself by refusing to accept what you've become. Imagine your chaos, darling. Stop playing their games, and you can do so much worse." Her laugh was bitter. "You think I can just let go?" she scoffed. "No. A wound must be tended to before it can heal. But oh, my sweet, what you will unleash when you're freed from that tether." He spoke as if he understood. He'd lived a life sheltered between canvases, immersed in a brushstroke meadow of his own making. But when he turned his face to the lamp, she thought she saw something ruined and monstrous. She blinked, and the light painted him anew in the same beauty as his work. Was there more to Matteo than she saw? He touched her cheek with a tenderness that made her vision falter. Arthi hadn't cried in years. She wasn't going to start now. Her eyes fluttered closed, and she felt herself lean into his touch. Little pinpricks of heat leaping to attention, pooling to simmer low in her belly. Because of Laith, her brain told her. But it was a lie. This felt different, heightened, amplified, not spurred by hunger. "I'm sorry," she whispered, opening her eyes. She didn't know what she was apologizing for, just that she felt the overwhelming need to. The great Arthi Casimir apologizing to the even greater Matteo Andoni. Matteo called out to no one in particular. "Someone fetch the presses." The presses, that was it. That was how they'd take down the ram. And they'd do it tonight. As much as Arthi loathed the fact that she'd broken her promise to herself and drunk from Laith, she couldn't ignore the clarity feeding had given her. She met Matteo's eyes. "I know what to do. Get everyone to Penn's office." He didn't even look surprised, only proud of himself. There was that damned dimple again. "As the Empress commands." 50. Jin. It had been 24 hours since Spindrift collapsed, and Jin was surprised by how quickly his devastation was devoured by rage toward the ram, as if his soul had taken the fires he'd lived through and decided to ignite one inside of him. Arthi joined him in Penn's office, looking different. Less wild and less pale. More herself. And Jin realized he hadn't seen this version of her in weeks. Perhaps months. She looked like a well-sated vampire leaving Spindrift at the end of the night. "You saved me," she said to him. "I thought it was time to repay the favour," he said, as casually as she did, as if neither of them had nearly lost the other. "Well," she said, "you're a decade late." That made him laugh, and he was stunned when she threw her arms around him. He almost didn't hug her back before she pulled away. She straightened her shoulders and turned as Penn, Flick, and Matteo arrived. "Where's Laith?" Flick asked. Jin hadn't known how to feel when he saw that Laith was no longer scheduled to be staked through the heart. He wasn't particularly fond of the High Captain, but he also hadn't really wanted him dead. Arthi had been the same. "Gone," she said, barely restraining her anger, and Jin wondered what had changed. "Our deal was for the retrieval of the ledger." "So he just left?" Flick asked, puzzled, but Jin knew not to push. Matteo looked like he knew more about the situation himself. Jin didn't like this. "I'm sorry, Arthi," Penn started. "For Spindrift." Arthi twisted her mouth. "Is the ledger still safe?" He nodded. "Give me what you have of your case," she said. "We're not going to bother with the court anymore. We're going to arrange a meeting between the ram and the press, and neither will know it. It'll be loud and public, and not really our style." But that was exactly the hand the ram played on Spindrift. Arthi had a way of speaking when a plan was turning over in her head. Probabilities and risks and chances running rampant. She'd changed since their fight. Whatever was wrong had righted itself. "We'll need to hit every newspaper at once," Flick said, clearly speaking from experience. Arthi nodded. "You're aware this will affect your mother just as much as the ram, right?" It was an odd question for Arthi to ask, and even Flick looked taken aback by it. It wasn't as if she would abandon her plans if Flick wasn't on board. To Jin, it looked more like Arthi was planting an idea, and he wasn't sure he approved. "I am," Flick said with a confident nod. "And I've got contacts with most of the papers," Matteo offered. "Good," Arthi said. "Jin and I have a few of our own. We'll invite them to a single location and give them what we know. They can badger the rest out of the ram, who won't be expecting to be bombarded by the press. Penn, do you have a place? I'd offer Spindrift, but it's temporarily closed." "The Aetherium has a meeting hall," Penn said. "It's not connected to the main building, so entrance doesn't require anything special. Excellent, Arthi said. Send word to the ram that we have the ledger, and we want to meet. Say nothing else. Will the ram believe it? Flick asked.
That the ram's taken everything from us and we're relenting because we're afraid of what more we'll lose?
Jin asked.
Yes.
The ram should have realized destroying Spindrift wouldn't make them cower in fear. They were beaten down, yes, but they were stronger now. There was nothing more dangerous than those with nothing left to lose.
It will still be risky. We want the ram to arrive after the press, so we can get the first word in. But if the ram does show up earlier, they might not know whom to believe.
I want everyone looking their best, Arthi added, wiggling a finger through one of the tears in the lapel of her jacket. I won't have anyone thinking any less of us.
Will going to the press make a difference, though?
Jin asked.
The people don't care about vampires, let alone them being abused and weaponized.
The people might not care for vampires, true, Arthi conceded. But suffering shouldn't be a secret, and the people will always fear the unknown. Right now, our focus is on the Wolf of White Roaring attack that led to the Ram's rise to power. We won't have proof, but if the press catches the monarch by surprise, they'll discern the rest, and there will be an uproar.
To what end? Matteo asked. Do you intend to usurp the usurper?
Only now did Jin realize they were truly in way over their heads. Arthi pursed her lips. If that's what it takes to make sure the ram doesn't threaten us ever again. Jin was aware the council that sat beneath the ram would just appoint a new mask, as a tenure always did. But that was a problem for the future. The ram loathed Spindrift and vampires far too much. A tenure might not have been the best of empires, but the ram was far too biased.
I think it'll work, Pen said, looking proud of them.
Jin nodded. They'll appoint a new mask soon enough.
Or maybe Arthi here can take the reins, Matteo teased.
Nope, I'll be busy rebuilding Spindrift, she scoffed. Why save the world when you can have tea? 51. Flick. When Flick placed her order at the family tailor for a gown, she had to shell out more than was necessary to keep the woman's mouth shut about it. She didn't need all of high society talking.
My sweetie, it is no good to wander without a chaperone, especially in this day and age, the woman was saying, setting aside Flick's fabric of choice. It was different from what she usually preferred, and it gave Flick a little thrill every time she thought of it.
You should have come with your mother last week.
Flick bid her farewell and left before she could hear any more. Of course her mother was having a new wardrobe made for herself while Flick was out there worrying about a stake through the heart. She sighed. Now she was just becoming bitter. Flick stopped and doubled back, peering into the window of Hera House, one of the only Giovanni-owned dressmakers in White Roaring. The trio of mannequins on the dais inside the window was wrapped in colourful swathes of cloth, the ends of them elegantly draped over their right shoulders. Saris, Flick believed they were called. Behind the one in sapphire blue, a girl in a tailored suit was placing an order. Baker boy hat pulled over her mauve hair. The woman at the counter smiled, and Arthi, in proper Arthi fashion, didn't smile back as she set her payment on the worn wood and made to leave. Flick hurried away, tucking into one of the alleys as Arthi leisurely made off in the opposite direction. And Flick began her walk to Admiral Grove once more. After what Lady Lyndon had done to her, she deserved to face the same consequence as the ram, bombarded with questions about her actions. Flick didn't expect to return to the Lyndon estate so soon, and she certainly didn't expect to feel so indifferent about standing at her mother's doorstep again. She was emboldened by the reminder that she wasn't alone anymore. She felt bad knowing Arthi and Jin had lost something dear to them,
while she was delighted at what she had gained. A family. As much a family as the Casimirs could be. One day she was an outsider. The next, she was simply included in every meeting, adding to every conversation, and joining every trip.
"Miss Felicity," the maid said at the door, eyes wide as saucers.
Flick said hello. Hushed voices sounded inside, and she heard the housekeeper snicker.
"Lady Lyndon said I'm not to allow you inside again."
She told herself not to be surprised, but it still hurt. "That doesn't seem fair." The maid looked away.
"No, it doesn't. She did say that if you insisted, I could let you in, though I don't think I'm supposed to tell you that."
Odd, Flick thought. She dropped her hand into her pocket for the comfort of her lighter before she remembered she left it on her mother's desk. She didn't need it anymore, she told herself. Pacify the people to keep them in check, and no one notices you furthering your own agenda. Arthi's words had been about the ram, but they had made Flick scrutinize each of her mother's actions in a new light. They had meals together, so Lady Lyndon could monitor how much Flick ate. Dress fittings together, so Lady Lyndon could be in control of how Flick dressed. She appeased Flick by taking her on outings that were convenient, when she was heading out for something anyway. Even that very first time Flick had visited Spindrift, she now remembered they went because her mother was to have a meeting with someone, not because she had wanted to take Flick. It was funny, Flick thought, how something utterly unrelated could uncover a side of her past that she had never noticed herself. Or perhaps it was because she had been removed from the confines of a life she had deemed normal, that she could finally see it for what it truly was. Her punishment hadn't even been a punishment at all. It was what it had always been. Lady Lyndon doing what was best for her reputation. And in the case of Flick, it meant hiding her away.
"Well, I'll only be in for a little while," Flick said. "And I appreciate you telling me."
The girl paused.
"I've missed you, Miss Felicity. The house hasn't been as warm without you."
Flick didn't feel so warm anymore. She was naive before, shielded and sheltered. Her mother had kept her in a cage, and Flick had extended her arms as far as she could every time she forged, until Jin had picked the lock and let her out. Her mother was in her office again, and Flick knocked, because she wasn't so angry this time. Lady Lyndon was at her desk. She contained her surprise quickly.
"Felicity, you have some nerve returning after the way you spoke to me."
"I only spoke, Mother," Flick said,
which was the problem, she supposed.
"I said nothing untoward or even disrespectful."
Her mother started reaching for the bell, and Flick had to bite her tongue against the panic that flared. She kept her voice calm, her words slow.
"Before you call to have me removed, you must know that all I wanted was to give you the front page again. This time, a praiseworthy one. I wanted to repair the damage you believed I'd done. I wanted your forgiveness so that you could love me again. I see now how foolish I'd been."
Lady Lyndon had the decency to look away. She felt bad, Flick realized. "No," came Arthi's voice in her head.
"Look closely."
Flick did. Her mother's shoulders were tight, rigid. She was unrelaxed, almost as if she was on guard. Almost afraid of what Flick might do.
"Whatever you heard about vampires, Felicity, you must know there's more to that story," her mother said, more tentative than sure of herself.
She was testing the waters. Testing her. It was a ploy. She was trying to get her to divulge what she knew. Flick wouldn't fall for any of it. This was her mother. She knew exactly how to guide Flick in whichever direction she pleased, like she was a puppet.
"And no, I'm not trying to get you to tell me what you saw or heard. I'm telling you that I was forced into dealings I'm not proud of."
Her mother spoke as if she wasn't Lady Lyndon herself, as if she had no sway or control over her actions. All this distance between us, her mother continued, it's because I was busy trying to make things right, trying to repair the extensive damage that was done to our company. But they'd begun drifting apart years ago. Flick started to say as much, to counter her, but then she realized that her mother was right. The distance between them had only worsened recently, and it was simply chance that it coincided with the signet ring scandal. It had nothing to do with what Flick had done. Her mother's hard mask fractured before she pulled it back on again, and in those seconds, Flick saw penitence. Flick understood it deeply, and that almost made her feel bad. "The ram used me," her mother whispered, "and it took you away from me." That was true remorse. It made Flick waver. When Lady Lyndon looked up, her bright blue eyes were wet with unshed tears. She gave Flick a smile, and it reminded her of when they'd have tea and biscuits in the nook by the window. It reminded her of their walks in the garden. Flick swallowed, suddenly wishing she hadn't come. She looked at the envelope in her hand for a moment, before she held it out. "Here, what is this?" Lady Lyndon asked. It was the address to the Aetherium's meeting hall, along with a date and time. "The coveted front page," Flick said. "A way to make things right." Flick had begun to question herself from the moment the Lyndon estate door had closed behind her. Now, back at the Aetherium, as she arranged her hair and swiped perfume at her neck, a little bit of sunshine to carry her through the long night ahead, worry wrapped around her shoulders like a coat. It was the right thing to do, she told herself. She pulled the gown over her shoulders. With all its folds and layers still weighing lighter than her heart, and soon realized she had never dressed herself for an event before. And after a good deal of time spent trying to tug the laces on her own, she gave up. She needed help, and the vampires of the Aetherium were the last people she'd go to. Flick snatched up her satin gloves, and holding the dress against her chest, she opened the door to find Arthi just about to knock. Flick almost didn't recognize her. Arthi Casimir was wearing a dress. The simplest way to describe her wrapped in a length of scarlet was regal. Beautiful. She wore a sari made of yards of silk, edged in gunmetal silver, wound around and around, covering every inch of her skin, except for the sharp contrast of her collarbone and the bold hue of her blouse, until it came to a brazen drape over her shoulder. She wore no baker boy cap. Her mauve hair had been teased into voluminous curls, framing the dark depths of her eyes. No, beautiful wasn't quite the word to describe her allure. She was cutthroat and deadly, the way a rose appeared entirely different when you saw its thorns. "I was hoping to find you," Flick said breathlessly as Arthi came inside. The hush-hush of the fabric echoed her steps. "Can you help me with these laces?" In hindsight, I should have thought twice before ordering a dress I couldn't wear on my own, now that I don't have maids. Flick turned without waiting for Arthi's answer, and it was easier to breathe without the weight of the other girl's gaze on her. "Thank you," Flick said. "Did everything go as planned?" Arthi asked, tugging and knotting with deft fingers. Flick nodded. I handed her the envelope. "I just wish... I don't know." "But you do know. Did you speak to her as I said you should?" "Yes," Flick said, and as grateful as she was to Arthi for telling her to prod and pry and pay attention to her mother's manipulations, she was still disappointed by it all. A part of her wanted to return to being oblivious. "I think I did better today than I did the first time, before we lost Spindrift, and I..." "Don't ramble," Arthi said, watching her. Flick sighed. She truly did sound remorseful, she tried to reason. Did she really, though? You're lost, Felicity, Arthie said gently, adjusting Flick's curls with a tender hand. And no one can find your way but yourself. 52. Arthie
had known from the moment Flick stepped inside Spindrift that the girl was eager to orchestrate a plan of her own. It wasn't difficult to figure out what that plan was. Not when Arthie was privy to Flick's circumstance. Arthie hadn't tried to discourage it. No, she'd done the opposite. Bringing up her mother often, dropping hints to remind Flick of whatever plan she had concocted, keeping the door open for whenever Arthie needed quick access to the head of the East Jevent Company. Like she did now. Slowly but surely, Flick grew more and more jaded. But that was the cost of the truth. I am sorry for dragging you into a fight that isn't yours. Arthie turned to find Penn in the doorway. It was the Ram's fault, though. All of this was the Ram's fault. And she didn't even know who the Ram was. But until she put her face to the one behind it all, the shadowy figure she met in the carriage would be the one she bloodied in her thoughts. Red suits you, little lion, Penn said, and she warmed at the compliment. It felt fitting, taking down the Ram in a red sari, the same red as her mother's death shroud. I heard about what happened between you and the High Captain, he said. Matteo told me. Of course he did, she said, unsurprised. You're different, Arthie. Half vampire, half human. When a person is drained of blood, they die. And if they're turned into a vampire in those precious seconds before the brain and heart cease to function, they're subdued. Hungry, yes, but too weak to do a thing. You were still very much alive when you were turned, weren't you? You had the means to act upon that hunger. An amplified hunger. Almost hungrier for the life you had just left than for sustenance. You barely even feasted as much as massacred. He reached for her hand. But that part of your life is over. Yet I spent the last 10 years afraid I would do it again, she said quietly. She spent half her life fearing herself, fearing what she was capable of, peering into the dark alleys of white roaring and looking for others like her. It was why she'd opened the bloodhouse, wasn't it? So that a vampire like her wouldn't have to brutalize the streets, but could pay to drink from a cup. You and Matteo have more in common than you might think, Penn said. Arthie laughed at that. Have you seen the man? Penn chuckled and then turned pensive. I think often of the day you lifted your pistol from White Roaring Square. The girl who was doomed to greatness. The choice of his words was not lost on her. This was a burden and not a blessing. She suffered more than she reaped. When all this is over, he said, locking his gaze on hers, we can return to Imperial Square. You and me, your crew, make it your new Spindrift. He gathered both her hands and held her close, pressing a kiss to the top of her hair. She lingered there a beat, allowing herself to feel small, to feel sheltered in his large body, allowing herself to feel her youth in the way White Roaring didn't allow. He spoke of the same comfort and safety he'd promised a decade ago. But Arthie knew how such things ended, even if she still longed for them. The voices in Penn's office fell silent when she entered. Flick wasn't here. Arthie looked at Jin first, because that was easiest. Oh, Arthie, I can't say I've ever seen you in a dress before, Jin said. You look beautiful. Arthie bared her teeth. How many of your teeth would you like to keep? 2 or 4? Jin laughed, and she could almost imagine this to be Spindrift. Slick counters behind him, the smell of tea warming the room. Most certainly Arthie under there. He started for the entrance,
patting the top of her head with something like pride.
I should get ready too.
He gave Matteo a look. Behave, Andoni, or we'll have some words.
Is everything in order?
She asked. Matteo blinked at her as if he hadn't heard a word she'd said. Arthi scowled.
I don't take well to being stared at. I believe I'm called exotic in your tongue, if you didn't know.
My tongue is quite capable, darling, Matteo assured her. Something prickled in Arthi's chest. And I'm more than happy to demonstrate. He leaned down, green eyes ablaze as they dropped to the exposed stretch of her collarbone. He worked his jaw, and she caught a peek of his tongue between his parted lips.
You are utterly dazzling, Arthi. Exquisite. A sight to behold because of that brilliant brain of yours.
It was rare to hear praise for her intellect. It was only ever treated as something that was overgrown to the point of recklessness. She was always told she was too cunning, too corrupt, never brilliant. He gave her one last look, adjusted the fold of the sari over her shoulder while searing her bare skin with liquid fire, and left.
53. Jin. Jin thought Penn had gone above and beyond to host the press at the Ethereum's meeting hall. Waiters and tailcoats glided about with trays, narrow flutes catching the light of the dazzling chandeliers high above. The gloss of the floors was complemented by the richly patterned rugs from a desert far, far away, and the decor that decked the place was dark and decadent. He thought he heard a sound and turned toward the shadows. Umbrella ready.
It's me. Jin's heart leaped at her voice. The dark is no place for a dove.
What if I don't want to be a dove? Flick moved into a wash of light. Her curls framed the soft beauty of her face. Several ringlets draped over her brow. A knot lodged in his throat.
What are you wearing?
What are you wearing? She sputtered back, just as surprised.
You said I'd dress like someone's dead, he exclaimed.
You said I'd dress like a flag, she said at the same time.
The silence gripped them. She looked glorious, clad in crushed velvet and the deepest, darkest emerald. It began with a tight collar around her throat, flaring before a cinched waist, where the wide folds of the skirt began. It held her the way she ought to be held. Tightly. Fiercely. Beautifully. He wanted to sweep forward and do the same. He wanted to bury his nose into her hair and inhale the sunshine of her spirit.
Lilac, she said stiffly.
She'd tugged gloves to just above her elbows, leaving inches of bare skin to taunt him.
You went with lilac.
The colour of your beret, he wanted to say, but it sounded stupid of him now, even if it had seemed like a good idea when he was ordering the jacket at the tailor. He wore it unbuttoned over a crisp white shirt, his black bordered kerchief tucked into the breast pocket, the ensemble completed by cream trousers. There was a guardedness in Flick's gaze, worry and concern rampant. Her mother would be here, Arthi had said.
It's going to be all right, Jin said.
Is it easier to have no heartbeat? She asked softly. To feel nothing at all? He didn't want her to think of her mother and the horrible things Lady Lyndon had done. He didn't want Flick to rethink handing her the envelope.
We're alone in a dark corridor, Jin said, tilting his head toward her. And you wish to philosophize?
For the rest of his days, he would recall the way her sunflower eyes went ink black at his words.
No, she whispered, and surged toward him, backing him to the wall of the alcove and stealing the air from his lungs.
He trailed his fingers up the smooth shine of her gloves, her breath caught, hooded gaze following the movement and sending a spike through his blood. And then, with a sweet little sound, she rose up and kissed him, softly, gently, driving him mad, He pulled away with a tsk, his voice a low scrape of want.
Let me show you how it's done, love.
He cupped her face between his hands and slanted his lips to hers. She gasped into his mouth, shuddering against him before she matched his push with her pull, pressing the length of her body against his, drawing a sound out of his throat, drowning him in that meadow of wildflowers and sunlight.
Flick, he whispered, half groan, half prayer.
She pulled back slightly, staring up at him with something like wonder and delight.
Say it again.
He crooked a lazy grin.
Really, Phyllis?
No, not the name she gave me. The name I made for myself. And he was so stunned by the force of her words, by the fervour of her spirit, that he did.
Flick.
He pressed a kiss to the bridge of her nose, where freckles fanned like stars in the night.
Flick.
He pressed another to the edge of her mouth, cherishing the sound of her irritation.
Flick.
He coaxed her mouth apart, and her breath caught when he bit down on her lower lip. Her arms settled to his shoulders, hands reaching for his hair, threading into the strands and pulling him tighter. He tasted hope in her kiss. Possibility. Jin felt good about tonight, and not only because he was finally kissing Felicity Linden. The clock tower struck 9. They pulled apart, breathless and dazed.
It was time.